It's hard to know what a magazine is these days. Is it the glossy paper product you get in the mail and buy at the newsstand? Or is it the website? The constant flow of information on the internet has forced all magazines to reconsider their definition. Reporter Martha Woodroof examines the process going on within the world of special interest magazine publishing.
Office Space doesn't come any more historic than the Virginia Quarterly Reviews. Their digs at the University of Virginia were designed by Thomas Jefferson. But the staff of this small international journal of print and discussion is not nearly as steeped in the past as their surroundings. They talk enthusiastically about the rich material they're able to offer readers through the VQR's website, even though editor Ted Genoways admits they don't exactly know what they're doing digitally yet.
We've got 80 years at our back for the print magazine. For the website, we're making it up as we go.
Genoways cites a project on poverty in Troy, New York, that's specifically designed to bust loose from the printed page.
We've sent a poet, a radio producer, and a photographer out into the field together. And I think that's, for us, really the first time that we've thought of the final product actually being the web product as opposed to the print product.
Waldo Jaquith is the VQR web editor.
The transition that all publications are going to have to start making is we have to view ourselves as an organization that creates content. Right. I hate that word, but content. But the physical product ceases to be the end product. It's a byproduct of creating this information.
So what is a magazine in these days of multi-platform presentation? Sid Holt, chief executive of the American Association of Magazine Editors, says he and some ASME members who work on the web were recently asking themselves that same question and came up with this.
A magazine has a point of view, and I think that's what really distinguishes a magazine from all other kinds of media. It has a very distinctive point of view, and it's the voice of the editor. And it's the voice of the editor in conversation with his or her readers.
But does technology influence what that conversation's about? Backpacker Magazine won 3 national magazine awards this year, 2 of them for Backpacker.com. Editor Jonathan Dorn says new technology brings Backpacker instant interactivity with its readers, thus meeting a much wider range of reader needs.
We are going beyond the sort of the simple idea of a website being a place where you go to read or look at something, to an idea of a website as a sort of a delivery vehicle where you go to download useful information or map that you're actually going to use in the field.
Backpackers readers, Dorn says, still want a print edition, but they also want access to information while they're hiking. Magazine subscriptions are at an all-time high, according to the Magazine Publishers of America. However,
anybody who thinks they know where this world of publishing is going is lying.
Emerson Blake edits Orion, an almost 3-decade-old magazine of environmental activism.
The question for a magazine like Orion that has limited resources is resource allocation. How much of our resources do we put toward a web-based presence now at a time when we have our hands full just trying to get a print-based magazine out the door?
These days, all magazines, great and small, are trying to figure out the process of their own reinvention, and even more importantly, how to make those reinventions pay. For NPR News, I'm Martha Woodruff.
The new school year is upon us, and all around the country, schools are experimenting with programs that offer students cash for reading books, showing up for study hall, improving test scores, and more. A lot of teachers say it works. Many students work harder when they can earn money, or, in some cases, valuable prizes such as cell phones loaded with free minutes. But should the classroom be turned into a workplace? Are young people being motivated, or does this cheapen the educational experience? NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax joins us to discuss capitalism in the classroom. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Good morning, Leanne.
Is this cash for class trend really catching on?
Well, Leanne, first let me just say that none of us are going to have much money in the future if U.S. schools don't do more to improve education. In my job here, I talk to a lot of people from business and trade groups, and when I ask them what's the most important thing government can do for the economy, they very often say education. talent. Employers are really aware that in a global marketplace, you need an educated workforce. So you've got business groups, lawmakers, foundations, school administrators, really everybody trying to figure out how to get kids to work harder in our schools. So the hard idea at the moment is to give people quick, tangible rewards for doing good schoolwork. Teachers are trying it out in New York, Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, all over in Texas. In Atlanta, for example, there's a pilot program that actually pays students $8 an hour to meet with a tutor.
Do these programs really work? Are test scores and attendance going up?
I looked at the findings of a lot of these programs, talked to education experts, teachers, and it's fair to say they're very divided. Supporters say that the cash rewards do boost classroom attendance and improve grades, but the programs do more than even just that. They get the parents motivated. Parents who didn't much care if their kids came home with a C are suddenly very interested when their kids come home with $100. So they're more likely to encourage them to study. So wherever these programs are being offered, the participation rates are really quite high.
So if parents like it and more students are working harder for good grades, what's the controversy?
Well, unfortunately, this issue really isn't as simple as it seems on the surface. That's because what we really want from students is not good behavior for an hour in class or even for the whole school year. What the economy really needs is for schools to turn out future workers who are motivated and enthusiastic over a lifetime. So we've got a lot of good psychological studies that show that these cash rewards produce temporary obedience, but the kids know they're being manipulated. They lose interest in learning as soon as the rewards are withdrawn. Some experts say that what we're really trying to do here is develop inner drive that allows a person to delay gratification and succeed over time. Students who love to read, who like to solve math problems, who like to do puzzles, those are the ones who grow up and intend to become the enthusiastic workplace leaders.
So given that mixed verdict, do you think these cash for class programs may begin to lose favor?
Well, the need to improve our schools is just so great that I think people are going to keep trying. It may be that some schools are, for example, trying right now to use direct deposit checks into individual savings accounts, and then they stress the importance of building up that nest egg for college. So for poor kids who've maybe never thought about going to college, it starts to build that ladder to the future.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Thanks a lot, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Leanne.
You're listening to NPR News. During the Nazi occupation of Albania and Kosovo during the Second World War, Jews facing persecution and death had a small group of seemingly unlikely allies, Muslims. 65 people managed to save some 2,000 Jews and have been honored by the Jewish Holocaust Memorial as righteous among nations. Photographer Norman Gershman spent 5 years taking photos of them and collecting their stories. They've been published in a new book, Bessa, Muslims Who Saved Jews in World War II. Mr. Gershman joins us from Aspen Public Radio in Colorado. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First, the title, Bessa. What does it mean?
Well, Bessa is a tradition of the Albanian people, and it goes back thousands of years. It's more than just a welcoming. It's their code of honor. And if one comes into one's Bessa, they would literally lay their lives down for you, friends or enemies.
You have a wonderful photograph on page 4 of Baba.
The Baba, yes.
The Baba. Tell us about him.
The Baba is the head of the Bektashi. The Bektashi is the most liberal form of Shiites. And I'm quoting from the book, "We Bektashi see God everywhere, in everyone. God is in every pore and every cell. Therefore, all are God's children. There cannot be infidels. There cannot be discrimination. If one sees a good face, one is seeing the face of God. God is beauty. Beauty is God. There is no God but God." And under the Nazi occupation, the foreign minister of Albania was a Bektashi, and he sent out a secret message to all Bektashi that the Jewish children will sleep in the same bed as your children. The Jewish children will eat the same food as your children. The Jewish children will be your family.
There are so many acts of courage and creativity in this book, a doctor, for example, bandaged the face of one Jewish man and kept him safe in his infirmary. And sometimes an entire village became a shelter for Jews who were fleeing the persecution. On page 70, tell us about Yaakov Kasseri.
Well, he is the person that rescued this family. There were Jews living in their village. He took them into hiding in the mountains of Albania because the Germans moving in were threatening to burn the Jews alive. He says, "I am proud to be recognized by the State of Israel as a righteous person. We have been family of Muslims for 500 years. Bessa came from the Quran. The Jews and Muslims of Albania are cousins. We both bury our dead in coffins. I salute all the Jews. May they be honored with their homeland, because the Jews are still at war and need to be remembered. I drain my glass of raki to honor all my Jewish friends." And this is very typical. One family said, "There is no Bessa without the Quran. There is no Quran without Bessa."
The son of one of the Muslims is photographed with three books in Hebrew. And I think that tells both stories, both about the communist Albania as well as, you know, the fact that a lot of these families were unable to reunite after the war. His name is Rifat, I believe.
Rifat Hoksha, yes.
Yeah, tell us his story.
It's a wonderful story. His father was given these three books to keep until after the war, when they would return to get their books back. And these books are prayer books. He didn't know what they were. He felt his father gave him this obligation to return these books to the rightful owners. He had no way of doing it. He had never been out of Albania. What can I do? Can I help him? And we ultimately found Aaron, the 10-year-old son, now in his 70s, we found him in Israel. And we brought Rifat Hoksha with the three Hebrew books to Israel to return these books to him. And while Rifat was in Israel, he was given a Quran. So here Rifat is going back to Albania with the Quran, and Aaron has these three Hebrew books.
Mm. What effect did this project have on you?
Listen, I photograph with my heart. In this particular case, clearly I'm a Jew. I'm a lay Jew. But I also have studied over the years with the Sufis. And the Sufis is the mystical side of Islam. The Islam I know is the Islam of beauty, of music, of dance, of poetry. I don't recognize this Islam that I read about in the papers. So it was a journey that I did with my heart. And it just reinforces that there are more good people in the world, far more good people in the world than terrorists or terrorist sympathizers. There are well over a billion Muslims. They're good people. Unfortunately, in the media, you rarely read or hear about the good people. I found the good people in Albania.
Photographer Norman Gershman, his book, Bessa, Muslims Who Saved Jews in World War II, is published by Syracuse University Press. Mr. Gershman joined us from the studios of Aspen Public Radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leon.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
A young medical student from the Central African country of Burundi barely made it out alive during the civil war that ravaged his country. Deogracias Nizonkiza, or Deo as he's known, fled Burundi in 1993 and managed to get to America.
A young man arrives in the big city with $200 in his pocket, no English at all, and memories of horror so fresh that he sometimes confuses past and present. When Deo first told me about his beginnings in New York, I had a simple thought. I would not have survived.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder reading from his new book, Strength in What Remains. It's the extraordinary true story of Deogracias Nizonkiza. He braved genocide, extreme poverty, a language barrier, and homelessness in New York City to become an Ivy League student and eventually to found a public health clinic in his home country. And along his journey, Deo found generosity and kindness in the most unexpected of places. I asked Tracy Kidder how Deo's odyssey began.
Deo was a young medical student when the Civil War in Burundi erupted. He narrowly escaped from the onset of that war on foot and made about a 6-month-long escape into Rwanda, where the genocide began, the notorious genocide. Escaped back from there to the capital city of Burundi, and through a series of rather complicated maneuvers, ended up getting on an airplane and going to New York City, to JFK.
A lot of people don't know much about that civil war. We remember what was happening in Rwanda, but as you point out, 300,000 people were killed in Burundi over a period of 13 years.
That's a rough estimate. I don't think anyone really knows how many were killed, but it was a truly catastrophic war.
How close was Deo to being killed when he decided to escape?
I guess about as close as you can get. The hospital he was working in was attacked by rebels, and he ran into his room and hid under his bed but forgot to close his door. And when they came to his doorway and he heard them say, "The cockroach is gone," he lay there listening to them and smelling the massacre, and then escaped after they had left.
Tracy Kidder, how did Deo end up in New York City 6 months later in 1994?
Well, he had a friend who had a European father and a Burundian mother, and he got a visa under false pretenses. He kept getting help along the way. When he got to JFK, he was being questioned in immigration. Of course, he didn't speak any English, and the agents didn't speak any French, and they called over this baggage handler, a guy, as it turned out, from Senegal, who not only translated but then invited Deo home with him. But home, as it turns out, was a tenement in Harlem. And he kind of showed him the ropes of the city. And he ended up working as a grocery delivery boy.
Mm-hmm. And along the way, Deo runs into a series of people who sort of save him.
That's true. Really quite extraordinary. He was delivering groceries one day to a little Catholic church on the Upper East Side, and he ran into a woman there, an ex-contemplative nun, whom I could hardly begin to try to describe to you, Guy, because I'm afraid I wouldn't do her justice, and I don't think I've ever enjoyed writing about anyone more.
This is Sharon McKenna you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm not a very religious person, I guess, but if there is such a thing as a holy person, Sharon is that person. She decided that Deo needed a family, and she set out to find him one. And then she found this couple. Charlie was a sociologist, and his wife is quite a wonderful and fascinating painter. Nancy, I mean, this is a perfectly sane, reasonable couple, and they took in a needy stranger from Africa who didn't speak their language, who had no means of support, and who might become their dependent for the rest of their lives. It's really quite an extraordinary act.
Why did Nancy and Charlie Wolfe decide to take in this refugee from Burundi who they didn't know at all?
The easiest answer to that is just to say that they are good people. But I think, partly they'd had some deep experience of Africa themselves. They'd spent quite a bit of time in Nigeria. They'd both become quite aware of the Rwandan genocide and were horrified by it. They, at some point just decided to take a chance.
Deo ends up living with Charlie and Nancy Wolfe for 7 years. And in that time, he goes on to gain entry to Columbia and then Harvard. How do you go from being a refugee in Burundi to sleeping on the streets and in Central Park, homeless, to then studying at two of the finest schools in the country?
Well, first of all, you have to be pretty gifted intellectually, I think, and you have to have a lot of desire. You'd expect a penniless immigrant who got into Columbia to major in something lucrative, potentially lucrative, like computer science. Instead, he did major in biochemistry, but also in philosophy, of all things. And I asked him why, and he said, because I wanted to understand what had happened to me. And of course, he didn't get the answers. He just got more questions. But I think to let his mind feel free to roam, to find, as he put it, his own peaceful corners around the campus and in the Church of St. John the Divine, I think, it was a place where his mind could begin to heal.
We should mention that for several years, Burundi was at or near the top of the World Bank's list of poorest countries in the world, with almost no public health service. Deo decides actually to begin to try and remedy this problem, and he founds an organization called Village Health Works. Can you tell us about that organization?
Well, Deo assembled a really large cadre of Americans, and they chose a rural village in Burundi and went to work there, building, first of all, a clinic and cleaning up the water supplies, doing, I think, all of the things that you're really supposed to do, both to promote public health and medicine. In its first year and a half now, the last figure I heard was that they had seen 28,000 individual patients. People have been coming from all over Burundi to avail themselves of the services of this place, and they've been coming from places as far away as Tanzania and the Congo as well. I mean, the word is spread. All the care is free to those who can't afford to pay. You know, I think Deo, like almost every idealistic person I've ever known, what he really wanted to do was to build something larger than himself, and this clearly has become that.
Tracy Kidder, this book is ostensibly the story of Deo's incredible journey from Burundi, but it's also about people like Deo, this what you describe as the invisible people in places like New York.
It's always interesting. It was interesting walking along Fifth Avenue with Deo. And, you know, on one side you have some of the priciest real estate in the world, and on the other you have Central Park. And, you know, I remember going by people's cardboard houses on one side and with the beautiful places, you know, the beautiful apartments on the other. But ever since I met Deo, you know, I've had to look at a lot of people differently, people with foreign accents especially in a place like New York, you know, janitors, hotel maids, taxi drivers, young men pushing grocery carts along Park Avenue. Who are they really? You know, what memories do they carry? What dreams? What sorts of abilities?
Tracy Kidder, he's the author of the new book, Strength in What Remains. He joined me from WMEA in Portland, Maine. Mr. Kidder, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Guy.
And you can read an excerpt from the book at thenewnpr.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Harriet Tubman is most well known for her work on the Underground Railroad. Prior to and during the Civil War era, she was called Black Moses because, like Moses, she led people out of slavery. But there's another chapter in Harriet Tubman's story that's not as commonly told. It caught our eye in a children's book by Thomas B. Allen called Harriet Tubman, Secret Agent. The title says it all. Tubman led a double life as a spy for the Union. Thomas Allen is in the studio with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why is the Harriet the Spy story not well known?
Well, it's tough to get stories about spies, particularly in Harriet's case. Unlike a lot of spies through history who write their memoirs finally when they go into retirement, she was illiterate. And so her handlers kind of put together the Harriet story, leaving out the spy, because it just seemed sort of untoward that this nice young woman would be a spy. And they also kept out her connection with John Brown, I mean, the original terrorist of the Civil War.
The abolitionist.
Abolitionist. Mm-hmm. And when he was arrested, he had papers connecting him to Harriet Tubman. And so there was, again, a feeling that if they got that out into her early biographies, it would look as if she was part of the John Brown system. So, as a matter of fact, he admired her to the point, oddly, he always referred to her in masculine terms. He would always say he or him about Harriet.
What real evidence exists that she did spy for the Union?
Well, she had been a friend of a couple of very active abolitionists in Massachusetts. When they get into the Union Army and they get down south, they say, well, let's bring Harriet down here because she can muster black troops. And that was her initial job. And then she and one of them comes up with the idea of a military action.
Really? You write that Harriet Tubman was the only woman to lead men into battle during the Civil War. When did that happen?
Well, they were down in South Carolina. And what the Union was doing was trying to do some economic damage, particularly to the South, by interrupting the traffic from the plantations, particularly the cotton plantations. And they were using rivers that would take small boats full of cotton down the rivers. And she got the idea, or at least someone with her got the idea, a group got the idea, of taking troops up the rivers, sending the troops out into the plantations on either side of the river, setting fire, destroying the plantations, and freeing the slaves on those plantations, putting them aboard the Union warships, taking them back downriver, and enlisting them in the Union Army.
Mm-hmm. On page 96 of the book, you write about a Colonel Rush Hawkins, and he talks about how spies were useful. And he says, if I want to find out anything hereabouts, I hunt up a Negro. If he knows or can find out, I'm sure to get all that I want. What was behind that sentiment? I mean, were they, you know, respected, or were they just being used?
Wow, it's really almost a foreshadowing of what happens in other wars, where you're using the natives, the people who live in the area, and you're hoping they're going to be giving you the straight dope, but maybe they're working on the other side and giving you bad information. Well, there isn't much doubt that a slave is going to give you good information. And there were things like telling you where the mines were in the rivers. They would row the boat out to put the mine in, and then they would either secretly disable the mine or get to a Union officer and say where the mine was. And that was one of the things that, again, Harriet was instrumental in getting put into action by the Union Army.
How involved was President Lincoln in this kind of espionage effort?
Absolutely not involved at all.
Really? He didn't know?
No. He had no knowledge. In fact, she was a little critical of him. She said that he's not moving as fast as God would like him to move. And that was in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Hmm. Was Harriet Tubman paid for her espionage?
No.
Really?
Yeah. She eventually marries a Union veteran and puts in a claim for a pension after his death. And eventually, it takes a long time, she starts getting a pension, but it's really as a result of having been the widow of a Union soldier, not as a result of having been a spy. But she mentions she has in her estate when she dies a musket and a U.S. canteen, a Union Army canteen.
When Hillary Clinton was the senator from New York, she kind of rectified that payment to Harriet. Tell us what she did.
Yes, she did. They figured out how much money was owed, and essentially that becomes part of the money that helps sustain the Harriet Tubman home in Auburn, New York.
Yeah, $11,000?
Yeah.
So, and that took care of the money that she should have received as
right.
a spy.
Yeah. I think it was not unusual for a spy to not be paid.
Hmm. And she couldn't get a military burial or anything like that?
No. No.
No.
It was more of her being a woman than being a black woman, I think. I mean, it didn't necessarily have to be black. If you were a woman, you're not going to get much of a attention from the Union Army at that time.
Thomas Allen is the author of Harriet Tubman, Secret Agent, published by National Geographic. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Videos that become the next big thing on YouTube can now cash in on their 15 minutes of fame. The website recently announced that users who create just one viral video are eligible for advertising partnerships with the company. YouTube wants to expand its revenue options, and it hopes videos like David DeVore's will attract more advertisers. His video of his young son's foggy behavior after a dental visit has been viewed more than 28 million times.
Do I have stitches?
Yes.
On my teeth?
Yeah, don't touch it. Don't.
Why can't I touch it?
Because it'll mess up the stitches.
You have four eyes.
Yeah.
David DeVore joins us from member station WUCF in Orlando, Florida, to tell us more. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Tell us how this partnership works. What do you have to do?
Have a funny video and just let it go crazy like ours.
Hmm. And the ads that go up there, you actually get some money for that.
Right. I believe it's every time somebody clicks through the ads, we get a portion of the revenue share.
How much money do you imagine you've made so far with this?
Well, I looked it up and we've made a little over $25,000.
That's significant considering.
Absolutely. I mean, it was found money. Just kind of a side note, I've been in real estate since 2005, and obviously we took quite a hit down here in Florida, and this extra income couldn't have come at a better time.
How many hits did your video have when YouTube offered you the deal?
Well, that was the funny thing. We put it on the first weekend of February just to share it with family and friends, and by that Tuesday, we had 3 million views.
How did they approach you?
It was just a small notification on the channel. Everyone has a channel or a page, and it was just a button to push to go through a set of a process to become a YouTube partner.
Now, your son was 7 at the time you filmed this.
Right.
And you were just doing it because...
Well, it was a combination of things. This was a pretty serious procedure, and my wife couldn't be there, and so I just decided to videotape the entire day. And I just put it on YouTube to be able to share with family and friends a lot easier with their link.
Yeah. Did you have any hesitations about doing this? I mean, if you put it on YouTube, there always is a chance that the world is going to see it.
Even in hindsight, I don't, even at the time, I wasn't aware. I know that there's privacy settings that you can limit how many people see it, but it defeated the purpose. What I was trying to do was to make it easier.
Did your son see it before you did that?
Oh, yeah, we watched it that night, and he just thought it was just hilarious, and it really helped him have a calmer reaction to having go to the dentist.
Huh. Given the ads now that are on that site, there have people who have complained that the ads don't always fit the videos. What's your experience been?
Mine has been positive. I mean, 90% of it has been dental related, you know, but the occasional pizza or Domino's, whatever it might be, they'll post it on there.
Are you making any more videos?
Well, we tried to do a few more, and those have garnered some success, nowhere near what we did. But to be honest, they were just kind of more of a reaction. Well, you have to put a new video up, but... We may do some in the future, but it'll just have to be what we want and not just because we can.
David DeVore recently became an advertising partner with YouTube after his video of his son after a dental appointment went viral. David DeVore joined us from WUCF in Orlando, Florida. Thank you very much, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
And give my regards to your son.
I sure will.
You can find a link to David DeVore's YouTube video at thenewnpr.org.